Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, your questions answered about electric vehicles. But up front, Pennsylvania is the nation's second largest producer of natural gas. Drilling in the Marcellus Shale region through the use of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, was an economic boom for some communities and resulted in thousands of jobs. Although there was no severance tax or specific severance tax enacted. But from the start, there have been questions about what fracking and drilling does to the environment and the health of the Pennsylvanians living near drilling sites. The state's 43rd grand jury made recommendations that they said would provide more transparency and help to ensure health and safety. A group of Democratic state senators have put those recommendations in legislative form, and one of them joins us today. We are joined by Democratic State Senator Maria Collette. She represents parts of Bucks and Montgomery County. Senator Collette, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator, in broad terms, what would this legislation do?
So it's a really exciting package of legislation that I am really proud to be a co-sponsor of. It's eight bills that talk about all of the issues that were raised in the 43rd grand jury report that you mentioned and the eight recommendations that were made there. Specifically, I have introduced a package of legislation with my colleague, Senator Steve Sanicero from Bucks County. And the three bills that we've introduced would provide our attorney general with concurrent jurisdiction in environmental crimes under Pennsylvania's Safe Drinking Water Act, Clean Streams Law, and Solid Waste Management Act. And, you know, one of the biggest barriers we have right now is that our attorney general's office can't do anything unless it gets a referral from a local district attorney. So they're unable to really go after polluters. And the Department of Environmental Protection or another agency with jurisdiction over that entity might be able to refer to the attorney general. But that process is cumbersome, it's time consuming, it's risky, it's uncertain, and it really doesn't allow for our attorney general to go after polluters the way that we need that office to be able to do. So this package of legislation really puts some muscle behind the office of the attorney general, even more muscle, I should say, and will let our office of the attorney general do its job to protect Pennsylvanians' constitutional right to clean air and pure water and allow them to go after polluters.
Why is it needed? Why is this, and by the way, I just want to clarify, maybe before I ask that question, you said these are eight bills. These are eight separate bills. This is not a this is not just one bill with eight segments to it.
That's right. It is eight separate bills that are introduced through co-sponsorship between myself and many other members of our Democratic caucus. And the bills range in number from SB 650 to SB 657, if anyone wants to look them up. But they talk about all of those issues that were raised, increasing setbacks from natural gas industry activity, disclosure requirements of fracking chemicals, securing clean air and water in Pennsylvania through oversight and monitoring, proper labeling of trucks that are carrying hydraulic frack waste, public health protection from harms, and then those three bills that I just talked about, which provides our attorney general with concurrent jurisdiction in environmental crimes.
You know, it's not uncommon, but it's also not routine that legislation results from recommendations from a grand jury. How did that happen?
Yeah, actually, what happened is we read the report, and it's really tremendously, you know, disappointing isn't even a word that captures what we read in that grand jury report about what is happening to Pennsylvania's environment. And then, you know, what happens to the people in our Commonwealth as a result of what's happening in the environment. So, you know, when we read the report, we got together and we said, hey, there's got to be a way for us to introduce the legislation that would really speak to the recommendations that came from that report. So, you know, again, when we think about our planet and we think about surviving and thriving, and we think about what's happening with polluting our ground and drinking water, when we think about the legal challenges that are presented with the Attorney General's ability to go after polluters in our communities, then we see these barriers and we say, you know, this grand jury report laid it all out, told us really what's going on here in the state of Pennsylvania. And so we followed suit and looked at how can we introduce legislation that's going to put the recommendations that were made from that grand jury into actual law so that we really put some teeth behind that grand jury report.
Now, you say what's really happening in Pennsylvania. That grand jury heard testimony from households, Pennsylvanians across the state, and from former and current state employees. I mean, what were some of the things that they said about what's happening across the state?
You know, this is one of the most devastating parts of it. When we hear reports and we hear firsthand accounts of people talking about contaminated drinking water, opening the spigot in their kitchen and seeing discolored water that has an odor coming out, and knowing full well that that's not water that they can give to their children to drink. It's not even water that they would give to, we'd give to our pets to drink. You know, I come from Montgomery County, and the area that I represent has been significantly impacted by contaminated drinking water. And we have known about this pollution that has gone on for decades. And unfortunately, you know, when we hear these stories, we hear about cancer clusters in areas where this pollution has taken place. We hear about people who are relying on outside sources for clean drinking water because the clean drinking water that's coming from, the drinking water that's coming from the wells in their communities is not safe to drink. And when we hear that, and we know that all of this is happening because of environmental contamination, then we can do something about it. We must do something about it. It is not acceptable that families in our communities are, fighting to get clean drinking water to come out of the tap in their kitchen. We can do better. We must do better. And I call on my colleagues in the Senate to move these bills forward, get them through committee, get them through the Senate and through the House and to the governor's desk for signature so that we can finally do some good things with regard to the environment here in Pennsylvania.
Now, that grand jury heard testimony from, I believe it was a total of 70 households and individuals all told. Were their claims verified or investigated? And the other question about that is, are we sure that the things that they were saying was related to the result of fracking or drilling?
Absolutely. So this was one of the things that we learned from the grand jury report that, you know, this people that testified that their well water was cloudy, black sludge, things like that, problems with breathing whenever they were in the shower because the water was contaminated. Absolutely. All of these things were verified. And, you know, the other thing that we heard about is, farming here in our Commonwealth is a huge industry. It is a big part of our Commonwealth. And Pennsylvania farmers testified also, and they talked about livestock, and they talked about, livestock becoming violently ill, infertile, dying, those kinds of things that affected not just the livestock, but the economy of those farmers as well. And so these items, these claims absolutely were verified. And it was made, you know, very clear through the Office of the Attorney General that these issues were the result of, waste and contamination due to industry in their area.
One of these bills would expand no drill zones in Pennsylvania from the required 500 feet to 2,500 feet. How is it settled on for 2,500 feet? Do you know that 2,500 feet away from a drill zone is enough to stop any kind of contamination?
Well, you know, that was the language from the grand jury report. And it's my understanding that my colleagues who are introducing that piece of legislation are relying on that grand jury report to give them some sense of, you know, 2,500 feet. And the truth of it is that, you know, we rely on experts when we start to craft this legislation. And I believe that Senators Comita and Sanicero were very diligent in figuring, you know, when they made this request of the 2,500 foot increase, you know, that it be something that absolutely does have a net positive impact when it comes to clean drinking water for people. So, you know, we rely on the grand jury report. We rely on experts that we use for research. And this is how we kind of come to these conclusions. And look, and at the end of the day, you know, part of this may be about negotiating with our colleagues in the Senate. And we start somewhere. We start with saying, hey, 2,500 feet was what was recommended from the grand jury report. Let's start there. And we'll see what we can accomplish through collaboration, through negotiation, through making sure that we are really, you know, getting to the heart of what's the best thing for people. And again, you know, that's the number that's specifically recommended in the report. And so that's my understanding is that's why my colleagues, Senator Comita and Sanicero, relied on that number.
Another one of the bills would conduct a comprehensive health response to the effects of living near unconventional drilling sites. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what you just said about the testimony from the grand jury, that a lot of this was anecdotal. Now, you said that it was verified, but that is something that has been called for, this comprehensive health response to the effects of living near drilling sites, since day one, and it hasn't happened up until now. I guess my question is, do we really know the extent of any kind of damage or maybe the lack of it if we don't have a comprehensive health response?
Well, I think that's why it's so critical that we're calling for that. You know, we want to base our responses on evidence. I think, you know, my background, I'm a nurse and I worked with, medicine and healing and treating people. And we practice evidence-based medicine. And so that's what, you know, understanding what are the public health implications of having this kind of waste in our groundwater and then in our drinking water and what that means for people, for livestock, for, you know, flora and fauna in our Commonwealth. We want to base all of these things on evidence. And like you said, when we have a comprehensive study and we're able to really look very closely at what this waste is producing, how it is impacting people, how it's impacting our communities, then we have a better sense of how we can move forward with helping to protect public health. And those two things don't have to be, exclusive, right? We can protect public health, and we can also make sure that our environment is being adequately, protected at the same time. They don't have to be, you know, separate things. So that's one of the things that we need to be really making sure that we're looking closely at. DOH has to be looking at the public health crisis and figuring out what the fracking health effects are. And so that's why SB 654 is being introduced to understand better how we can really make sure that residents aren't being negatively impacted.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about HIPAA and vaccines and, you know, what privacy rights you have or don't have when it comes to divulging whether you've been vaccinated or not. A lot of people have questions about that. We'll be discussing it on tomorrow's Smart Talk as well. On this segment of today's program, we're speaking with Democratic State Senator Maria Collette, who represents part of Bucks and Montgomery counties, about a series of bills introduced having to do with Marcellus Shale natural gas drilling. And the eight bills, by the way, you can see those eight bills, exactly what they would do on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator Collette, Pennsylvania is the second leading natural gas producer in the country. There have been ups and downs in the last 10 years, but it is an industry that did create jobs. It provided some economic success for some struggling communities, and it generated millions of dollars in impact fees. Now, I did mention in the introduction there has not been a severance tax enacted, something that Governor Wolf and others have called for a long time, but it hasn't happened. There would be some people, or there are some people out there, who would say you're trying to kill the golden goose, that this is an economic boom for Pennsylvania, and putting regulations like this on the industry would really hurt it economically. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I have to say that's just a tired argument, and it is absolutely not the case. Regulating this kind of industry that has the potential to have such incredibly detrimental effects to public health, to our environment, is not the wrong thing to do. And we can see from other states that have enacted stricter regulation, that do have severance taxes, that in fact, it hasn't killed the industry in those other states. And, you know, when that argument is continually trotted out, and it's most often trotted out by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle as a reason for us not to enact, you know, policies that are going to allow us to hold polluters accountable, to make sure that our environment and the people who live in our communities are safe and are able to have clean air and clean drinking water here in our Commonwealth, something that, by the way, is guaranteed in the Constitution, then, you know, we really have to call them on the carpet for it. Texas has a severance tax. Has it impacted their production? They're number one. We're number two. So, you know, I would say look to these other states and stop trotting out the same tired old argument that absolutely has no basis in fact here. We absolutely 100% can protect public health and the environment and still ensure that we have a thriving industry here. The two can go hand in hand. We have to compromise, collaborate, and we have to be creative about what those solutions will be. But, you know, this same old argument that we can't possibly regulate this industry or else it's going to just, you know, fade and go away is just absolutely ludicrous. And I don't give it even a moment's thought.
But the political reality is that you're in the minority, and Republicans have opposed many legislative efforts to regulate or obviously tax drilling. So I know you've used the word several times, compromise, but again, let's look at it realistically that in 10 years here in Pennsylvania, there really hasn't been a lot of compromise on this issue. And that's what you're looking for. So what areas can you see some compromise, and what do you do when you are in the political minority?
You know, that's absolutely the best point here today, right? That is the political reality of this. And I hope that people across the Commonwealth are paying attention to the leaders that they've elected. And, you know, when they turn their spigot on and the water that comes out is discolored and has an odor and they cannot give it to their children, their pets, themselves, they can't even cook with it or bathe in it. And I hope that they're paying attention to what their leaders are doing to solve that problem. It is absolutely, you know, to me, it is reprehensible to be elected as a leader in this Commonwealth and ignore what people need, want, and deserve. And that is safety in their public health. It is a clean environment. It is the ability to go about their business, raise their children without fear of some environmental contaminant that could have been regulated and protected and prevented from making them and themselves sick. And so them and their families sick. And, you know, you're right. This is the political reality. And I challenge people across the Commonwealth to pay attention to what their leaders are saying and what their leaders are doing. It's one thing to stand up at a rally and say, you know, I'm going to be here to protect the people of Pennsylvania, and then go into a room. And it's a completely different thing to go into a room and vote absolutely not in the best interest of the people of Pennsylvania. And so that's what I would challenge everyone who's listening today to remember, that you elect leaders to go to Harrisburg to stand up for your community, your environment, your family, yourself, and they're not doing it. They're not doing it.
An observation, though, most of the time legislators, both Democrat and Republican, that represent districts that where drilling is happening, the southwestern part of the state, the northeastern part of the state, that most of them aren't on board. I'll get it out yet. Aren't on board with this. And as I said, both Democrats and Republicans. Do you have any legislators on board from the Northeast or the Southwest?
Well, you know, this is part of what I talk about when I talk about collaboration and compromise. And so this is one of the things that we have to start talking to our colleagues about, to help to move them along, to get them to understand that the public health implication here is great, and it is absolutely impacting the people in the communities that they represent. So this is the introduction of legislation, and that's the first step. But the work begins now with us making sure that we are talking to our colleagues and that they're understanding why this legislation not only improves the quality of life for people in our Commonwealth and public health, but also helps to improve natural gas extraction oversight. And it's not necessarily tied to severance taxes. So we can do both. The members in my caucus have continually said we can do both, and we have done a lot of great work to try to figure out how we can do both here in our Commonwealth. And I think it's I just think that to ignore that, to say that it's one or the other and it's always a zero sum game, is really unfair to the people of our Commonwealth. And we can do both. Other states have done both. They are doing both. And we need to be able to do both as well to protect the people in our Commonwealth. That's really what it comes down to. Absolutely, industry is important. We need to make sure that we have good life-sustaining jobs, that people are earning a good wage, that they have work that they can take pride in. We absolutely want to do that on the Democratic side of the aisle. And to paint, the Democrats who have, been behind this legislation as wanting to kill industry is also, just sort of a red herring. We absolutely don't want to kill industry. We can do both. We know we can do both. We've seen other places do it. And so it's just going to take that extra step and making sure that our colleagues on the other side of the aisle understand that the health implications here require them to act.
Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about geography. This sounds simple to many people, but it is a political reality in Pennsylvania that there is a rural-urban divide, too. But you're a state senator from the southeastern part of the state. Fracking is banned along the Delaware River. A legislator in those areas of the Northeast or the Southwest is saying, listen, why are you coming into our business when, this is something that is an industry that employs people in my area, has helped economically with some of the communities in this area? Why are you bothering with this when you're a southeastern Pennsylvania state senator?
So, that's a great question. And the truth of it is that we are not immune from, contamination in our ground and drinking water from chemicals that could have been regulated as well. Of course, that I have a military base in my district, part of which is still active, much of which is not active anymore. But we have had groundwater contamination from per- and polyfluoroalkyline substances that has occurred for decades. And those came from firefighting foams that were used in those military bases. So we're not immune to the hazards of contaminated ground and drinking water. We have members from the western part of our state who are in the Marcellus Shale Corridor who have signed on to this legislation. The water runs downstream. We know that from studying the effects of those PFAS chemicals. They certainly do not stay on the borders of that military base. Water moves, and we know it moves. And so when we have frack waste in water that's in one part of our state, we know that it is just an inevitability that it's going to impact other parts of our state as well and the people all across our state. So you ask me, how dare you come into this area and regulate what's happening here in my community? Well, let me tell you something. When what's happening there in your community has the potential to impact the people in my community, you're damn right that I'm going to stand up and say, hey, we need to do better. Because I have a duty to the people that elected me to our state Senate to stand up, fight, and say what's happening across our Commonwealth has the potential to impact every single person in our Commonwealth. And that's my responsibility, to stand up and fight for the people of the state. I'm going to continue to do it. And I'm going to continue to challenge my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to continue to fight for the people they say they're fighting for.
Senator, any one part or two or three parts of this legislation that you think are more important than others? Or maybe I should ask the priorities.
I really think that it's my priority, really, I think to me, it's incredibly important that we talk about providing the Attorney General with concurrent jurisdiction. I have to tell you, as you know, that we have diverted water sources for people so that they are able to get clean drinking water. But that often comes at the expense of the ratepayer and the consumer. And that's absolutely unfair. We need to give our Attorney General the teeth to go after polluters, to make sure that we are compensating communities and people appropriately so that they are able to live their lives, drink, and have access to clean water, but not have to open their pocketbooks to pay for cleaning up contamination that they didn't cause. So for me, the priorities really are making sure that our Attorney General has the teeth to go after people that are committing environmental crimes.
Democratic State Senator Maria Collette, she represents parts of Bucks and Montgomery counties. Senator Collette, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. President Biden threw his support behind electric vehicle technology recently by including transition incentives in the $2 trillion infrastructure plan. When General Motors announced that by 2035 they will only make electric vehicles, it became clear this isn't a fad. Electric vehicle technology has been called the biggest revolution in motoring since Henry Ford's production line first started. So what's all the excitement about, and what should we understand about the technology? Joining us is Christopher Van Staveren. He's an assistant professor in automotive technology at the Pennsylvania College of Technology. Professor Van Staveren, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Scott, for having me on today. I look forward to speaking with you today about this.
This is your opportunity.
Electric car.
Hold on just a second. Let me just tell our listeners that if you have a question about electric vehicles, this is your opportunity. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I'm going to start with a basic question. How would you describe how an electric vehicle operates? How does it work?
All right. Electric vehicles work very similar to a conventional gas-driven engine or diesel-driven car. People that have, get in these cars and drive them really don't notice any real difference in the way they perform. Some cases, they perform actually better. Of course, the starting process is a little different. You don't start an internal combustion engine. You just enable the vehicle to drive. But as far as the actual operation, it operates very, very similar to a conventional car. The great benefits of it is that they don't smell. They tend to be a lot quieter. And of course, they get much better efficiency.
And one of the things that I understand about electric vehicles is there are fewer moving parts than a gas-powered vehicle. Few, if any, probably some, but few fluids. Is that accurate?
Yeah, pretty much. Everybody is used to going and getting their oil changed in their internal combustion engine. The internal combustion engine is very inefficient. Even the most efficient internal combustion engines only utilize about 35% of the energy that goes into the gas tank to propel the vehicle down the road. And one of the primary reasons is because internal combustion engines, the pistons start and stop. You bring in air and fuel. A lot of that air and fuel is converted to heat, which is effectively wasted, turned into heat in the cooling system and going out as heat through the exhaust pipe. And so it's not internal combustion engines are not very efficient, whereas an electric motor, it does generate heat by converting the electricity into mechanical movement. And there are cooling systems. So there's coolant and there's oil to lubricate everything. But it's more efficient because you don't have things starting and stopping, pistons going up and down. And a much, much higher percentage of the electricity that's coming from the battery is actually propelling the vehicle down the road. And on top of that, in an AC motor, and basically can also be a generator. So when the battery is, the battery's electricity is being converted to mechanical movement to power the vehicle down the road, when the vehicle needs to stop, the opposite happens. So effectively the motor becomes the generator and recharges the battery. So the energy that you use to accelerate is then recaptured, recuperated, and then is used to charge the battery back up so that when you come to the stop, you can use that energy again to power the vehicle. Whereas with a conventional gas-powered vehicle, when you take your foot off of the accelerator and it comes time to stop, through the friction in your brakes, you basically take the kinetic energy of the vehicle in motion and convert it to heat, which is lost. So it's inefficient.
Well, what we're going to hear a lot over the next few years about the benefits of electric vehicles. And of course, as you're well aware, there are people who are, have questions about, well, what about this? What about that? But the benefits, obviously the main benefit, as you said, is that it is more efficient, but it is cleaner. It is cleaner for the environment. And, as President Biden said, we want to get away from fossil fuels and, and this is all geared toward trying to slow down climate change. So let's talk about that. Do you have to weigh the benefits against what may not be, a benefit that you would get with a gas-powered vehicle?
I think so. And I think overall, if you were to look at the cost of the electric vehicle, and they vary in range from, the high 30s, low 40s, and upwards of $100,000. So it really depends upon which vehicle you're getting. But the overall cost of owning that vehicle, that electric vehicle, through its life, is going to be more economical and beneficial. It's going to lower cost to the owner of the electric vehicle. If you think about what's not necessary with an electric vehicle, and the cost of electric vehicles are coming down. Basically, one of the very large costs of it is the battery. There's depending upon what model you get, and within that model, what range you expect to need to be able to drive will determine the size of the battery that's in the vehicle. And the battery is one of the very large costs. But if you take out just the cost of the battery, which you would hope that over time scales of production and everything would bring that cost down. There's no internal combustion engine that has to be purchased. There's no fuel tank. There's no exhaust system. And there's a lot of other systems that internal combustion engines needed to have: emission control, catalytic converters. And we all know how expensive catalytic converters are nowadays. Those are things that don't have to get put into an electric vehicle. So I think the cost is going to come down significantly, or at least not increase as dramatically as it as it has in the, you know, the past, you know, maybe 2 to 3 years.
One of the things that when you talk about the cost, that is one of the objections that some people do have to buying an electric vehicle now. And as with everything, when there are more of them on the road, the cost probably should come down. But, you know, something that people don't think about is that when we buy a vehicle, for the most part, unless we're being good consumers, we don't think about what it costs down the road. We like the looks of it. We like the handling. We, you know, there are different things we like when we see it on the lot. But that's good. I would think would have to be a big selling point for electric vehicles is over the lifetime of the vehicle. Yes, you may have some sticker shock right up front, but over the lifetime of the vehicle, you're probably going to be paying less. Now, I'm going to be jumping around with you, Professor, with some questions coming in from listeners. We have one from a listener wants to know, how do electric vehicles perform in very cold weather conditions?
In very cold weather conditions, the battery life is not, or the battery range is not what you would typically get if the battery were warmer. But with that said, the cooling system for the electric motor and the electronics can also heat the battery up. So in the morning, if you were to come out and let's say it was 20 degrees and your vehicle was fully charged, as you start it to drive the vehicle, of course, as you convert the electricity from your battery to, you know, through the motor to mechanical energy, that creates heat in the electric motor. It also tends to start to heat the battery up. So if you were to drive a vehicle that had a very small battery and it was extremely cold out, your range would be very limited. But as the battery warms up and as the, you know, the vehicle's in operation, it tends to bring the life of the battery back. So that's one concern in extremely cold environments. And like diesel cars and, you know, Minnesota diesel powered vehicles, people have always had to plug their vehicles in, you know, to the, you know, the electric system to basically keep engine crankcases warm and batteries warm and things like that. Up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, in the very cold parts of the country, it'll be no different with electric vehicles. They'll need to be plugged in to stay warm, to keep the batteries warm.
I wonder whether Pennsylvanians realize that that happened in Minnesota and Wisconsin in cold climates. Another objection, if you will, or something that people are anxious about is the range of the vehicles. I mean, most of them now that are on the market have a range of around 250 miles or less. And if they have to be recharged, now, obviously, if you have one and you can just plug it in at home overnight, that's fine. But if you have to charge down the road, it would take 20 minutes at a minimum to just, you know, get you going again to where you have enough range to get where you're going. So what about that? I mean, that with the infrastructure we have now, that would seem to be something that would be a cause for concern that, oh, I'm going to go my 250 miles. I'm not going to be able to find a place to plug in, and I don't have 20 minutes, a half hour to do that. What about that?
And that's a valid concern. And as more infrastructure is added through the country, you may find that that's going to become less of a problem. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, people that want to do range and do efficiency have hybrid options, which was, you know, basically the early electric technology was developed through hybrids. So people would opt to do that, which is still much more efficient. A hybrid is much more efficient than a conventional gasoline-powered vehicle. But going back into the answer to the question about the charging systems, it really depends upon the vehicle. Tesla has superchargers out there, and they're supercharging stations. I mean, in Williamsport, at our, you know, local fueling station, they have two superchargers. And a supercharger will bring a Tesla battery that's at about 15% up to about 85% in about 20 minutes. If you have to drive it across the country, a Tesla across the country, and many people have done this, it's doable. It's a little bit less convenient, though. But if you look at what it costs to charge a battery up to drive, 250 miles, you're looking at approximately $6 to $7. And of course, it depends on what electricity costs in the area that the vehicle is being charged. But if you could, you know, if you think about it, 220 miles for $6.50, that's very efficient. And so, you know, if for people that are have that range, oh, I can't buy one of these because I won't be able to use it the way I want to use it. That's a valid concern. But as more and more infrastructure comes out, then I think that's going to become less and less a problem. And on another side note, they're investigating basically automated systems where you will switch a battery out. So instead of charging your battery up, imagine you went to a fueling station and the fueling station was completely automated. You pulled your vehicle in. The robots basically scanned your vehicle, scanned the computer systems of the vehicle. Automated robots removed the battery from the underside of your car and replaced it with a fully charged cell, and that battery then went to get fully charged for the next vehicle. That is being developed right now, not necessarily in the United States, but in other parts of the world. So in that case, you know, possibly in 10 minutes, you could have an entire battery swapped out and give you another 300-mile range. So, you know, we're kind of in the early days of electric vehicles. I mean, they've been out, General Motors had the EV1 back in the 90s, in the mid-90s. And we learned a lot by having that vehicle in operation. And Ford had an electric Ranger back then, too. And it was all driven by CAFE standards in California to come up with zero emission vehicles. So as we learn more and more and the marketplace develops different ways to accomplish what people want, I think that this is a good thing. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what's developed in the future.
I said that, we would have questions about some of the objections. And part of it is because this is new. Let's take a call from Mark in Gettysburg. Mark, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, thank you. My question is the environmental impact of the production of batteries, the elements that are mined that are required, the electricity it takes to produce these batteries, the materials that go into it, that somehow are not part of the equation and have their own impact on the environment. And by the way, the previous question also brought to mind another question. When you use the air conditioner, doesn't that reduce the power, the life of the battery or the distance?
Mark, thank you very much for your questions and your comments. And let's start with his first one about the overall environmental impacts of this. And really, you know, one of the things that Mark does bring up is because this is new, we don't know about battery disposal, but he was talking about the manufacturer of the batteries, that sort of thing. What about the environmental impact, Professor?
And that's true. I mean, it's the concern basically for the battery. It's a car in general. To manufacture a car is very energy intensive. Effectively, what it comes down to is we have to mine the lithium. Most modern cars, if not all new designs, run off lithium ion or lithium polymer batteries. So sourcing lithium and doing it environmentally friendly way and creating the batteries is an environmental challenge. And I don't think Mark is correct. I don't think that's equated into or put into the part of the equation is the overall greenness of an electric vehicle. We don't currently have widespread mass recycling efforts of lithium batteries. And I know a lot of the early lithium batteries that are no longer viable for use in an automobile or in stationary power supplies. So people would put them in their house and hook them up to solar cells, and they perform, you know, a function in that regard. But I'm convinced that at some point in time, the technology is going to be there to recycle lithium ion batteries in an environmentally safe way. The market always figures out a way. That's the great thing about this country and in the free market societies is we figure out how to solve challenges. And that is currently a challenge. On another note, if you're, you know, it, it to look at the manufacturing of a vehicle with an internal combustion engine, we have to cast the engine block. We have to create the crankshaft. That all, of course, is energy intensive as well. If we can, you know, we have to mine the platinum and the rhodium and the other elements for catalytic converters. That there's an environmental cost to that as well. So really, economists would look at both sides, the electric vehicle's overall footprint on how, you know, what it takes to manufacture something that versus the internal combustion engine. But it's not just the electric vehicles that are very intensive to create. The conventional car was as well.
Mark's second question about air conditioning, and I guess you could take that to other parts of the vehicle as well.
Yep.
I mean, your radio is not going to suck a lot of energy, but still, if you start adding these things on, air conditioning is one of those things, heat and air conditioning, that does sap up a lot of energy. Would that lessen the performance of the battery?
Oh, definitely. Anything, like you said, anything that uses electricity is going to degrade the battery or cause it to discharge faster. The air conditioning is a very large one, and that's, you know, because you have to run a compressor to remove heat from the combustion compartment. The adding the heat would be, once the system was warmed up, it would be similar to a conventional car, but they would probably supplement it with a little bit of, you know, electric heating grids in order to heat the vehicle up. And to give you a little side note, we have at the college, we have a Nissan Leaf. It's a fully electric vehicle, and we participate in the Green Grand Prix up in Watkins Glen, and it's for, you know, green cars, electric cars, hybrids, etc. And last year, our Nissan Leaf we bought was sold. It was basically originally in California, and it has the smallest battery, so it doesn't have a lot of range. I think the range on it was 78 miles. By turning everything off, and it, you know, as the battery starts to run low, it starts letting you know that you have the ability, or in some cases, it will decide for you, and it will start turning electric things off in the vehicle that are not necessary. And I was able to take that Nissan Leaf and complete the 83-mile Green Grand Prix circuit on one charge of the battery, which let me go to judging, which was good. I was pretty pleased with that. But I was very nervous at the very end. And typically what will end up happening with an electric vehicle is, as it won't just shut off, it's going to give you a warning. It'll go into a limited operating mode. It'll limit the speed you can go. And if you keep driving and it's, you know, degrade it farther and farther and farther, eventually it will shut off. But to think that you're driving down the highway and all of a sudden it's going to be, your battery's done, you're off on the side of the road, it doesn't work that way. It lets you know ahead of time that you need to start looking for charging, or you need to look for a place to pull over.
Professor, we have a question from Rich, who asks, we're building so many electric vehicles. Amazon, U.S. Postal Service is going to switch over. How is the electrical infrastructure going to handle all of this? Is the infrastructure in place now? And he's not just talking about charging stations, but the electric grid itself to handle so much more electricity out there?
That's a great question that I don't have an answer for. I think that the designers are taking that into consideration. I think that if everybody were to right now go out and buy an electric vehicle, of course, we couldn't supply the need of that. In today's electric grid, I don't think we could do it. But as General Motors does away with internal combustion engines by 2035, the hope is that, you know, the grid is going to be modernized, and that we will then be able to have the capacity. And of course, the electric grid, as was evidenced by what happened in Texas, is not the same all over the country. I mean, there's areas that have plenty of electricity and can support it, and there's areas of the country that right now could not support it, and in the future might not be able to support it. But I would believe that as the technology comes in, once again, the electric companies and the electric grid are going to have to adapt for it.
We have a
Now I think that if everybody had an electric vehicle, it wouldn't work.
Quick note here from Dan says their family recently switched to an all-electric Nissan Leaf and a plug-in hybrid family vehicle, and they love the ease and convenience of being able to charge their vehicles at home and avoid the gas station.
Yeah.
We only have about 30 seconds left.
Part of our mission to deliver relevant.
We only have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to ask, you know, with your students, are you able, will they have the knowledge to be able to work on these vehicles? And I have to restrict you to about 15 seconds.
Oh, definitely. We basically cover the basics of electricity and electronics and any more, many issues that are related to these electric vehicles are not mechanical in nature, they're communication. They're module to modules talking to each other. And we cover that conventional cars, hybrid cars, and electric vehicles. That's
Christopher Vince,
major function.
Christopher Vince Staverin is an assistant professor in automotive technology with the Pennsylvania College of Technology in Williamsport. Thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.